I would like to now welcome our speaker, Bill C. from Torrance.
Hey, everybody. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I'm here to clean up after Israel. You know, don't you just love the Zoom thing? I think that Zoom has given the world more access to Alcoholics Anonymous than it's ever had. And the other thing that it's done is a lot of us that live far apart from each other have gotten to know each other a lot better on Zoom. We get to see each other. I get to see Israel, you know, fairly often. You know, I find out he's talking, show up there, or be on meetings together. What a treat that is, huh? What a treat. But boy, it sure is good to be back live, isn't it? I ran into Israel's sponsor the other night in Woodland Hills. I went back speaking live, and Bob and I talked about the fact that we see each other more on Zoom than we have over all these years, you know. But it's really good to be back in the room live and feel the energy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been feeding off of that for years. One other quick thing before I get going here. Israel mentioned Scott Redman. It's been over 15 years since Scott died, and I think about him almost every day, and I miss him today as much as I did not long after he died. He started talking about him, and I started tearing up, you know, how much I cared about him and loved him, and he was a real significant person in my life, and there have been many of those in the times. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. I don't know about you, but I'm very impressed by that. I think that's pretty impressive. And who knew? I don't think any of us ever planned to be here for the rest of our lives, but a bunch of us I can see on the screen certainly have been. And what a gift this life is. Another thing, I'm always stimulated by what Israel has to say. And maybe what we can talk a little bit about today. I think today I probably speak more to the person that's been around AA for a while, and maybe they're in their last 30 days or they're struggling and they're just kind of on the periphery a bit, and they're showing up to some meetings, but they've hit a doldrum. They've hit a spot, you know, maybe the third or fourth or fifth or sixth surrender. They talk about the second surrender a lot. They don't tell you about the third, the fourth, and the fifth one. You know, life goes on, stuff happens. Life just happens to us like it does to anybody else. And sometimes you can be stuck here in AA and you are just kind of drained and it's empty. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. And I know that there's a lot of people, anytime you're talking in front of a group of alcoholics, you can bet that probably half the room or more has a problem with the whole God thing, even if they've been here for a while. You know, you ask people questions, like somebody will come up to you and ask you, you know, can we talk? You know, I'm 19 or 20 years sober and I've hit a soft spot and you were speaking to me. And you ask them, have you worked the steps? And they'll say something along the lines of, well, yeah, I've worked the steps, but not like what you're talking about. Like, am I talking about something weird or strange or some right-wing version of working the steps? No, I don't think so. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit. What does it look like when you've been around a while? What's it feel like? You know, how do you stay involved? How do you stay connected? You know, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit today. So I've been sober quite a bit longer than I drank and used. And I started drinking and using with some, you know, commitment when I was 14 or 15 years old, and I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at 37. So when I got here, I probably had the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and this kid was not an honor student, the one that's mature beyond his years. You know, he's the one with a bit of a problem with authority. That kid, remember him? And I looked like I was growing up, but I wasn't. And my contention here is that, like, a lot of alcoholics talk about alcoholic thinking, you know, and I have my doubts about whether we have special thinking or not. I just think that we're emotionally immature and we like to think that we're kind of uniquely neurotic And that has not been my experience with myself or with many of you that I've interacted with over the years. I think we're just emotionally immature because we got loaded when the lessons were being handed out. You know, by the time I was 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. I had a big jacket and a slouch and a sneer and a foul mouth and a bad attitude, and I carried a gun and had already been to jail. And I'm from the mean streets of Palos Verdes. Like, there's no gangs in Palos Verdes. Nobody was looking for me. You know, I was a gang of one, you know? I mean, I was very delusional at 17, but it seemed like it was real, you know? It seemed like it was real. And, you know, I think the whole idea behind the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, was to have a couple of pops and get out of the house and go have some fun. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. You know, it's like, I'm having sex menage a uno. There's no one else in the room. You know, it's like, we're partying with Billy now. It's getting serious, right? At 22, I'm in a mental institution. My story in a nutshell, in order to get it over with, is I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I rarely went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt, and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. I have it tattooed here on my arm. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y, Horney, with an exclamation mark for emphasis. Right? So that's pretty much all you need to know about me, isn't it? You know? 22, I'm in a mental institution. I had got married. I had two little kids, and I'm not coming home to that family, and I'm running with an outlaw motorcycle gang and sticking needles in my arm and drinking like a fish. And it was awful. It was awful. 22, short party. Short party. It wasn't much of a party for a lot of us. You know, I mean, I'm a child of the 60s, and I can't really tell you a lot of stories about the 60s. Doug Rowell's here. He can tell you some great stories about the 60s. That's his job in AA, is to remind us that of the fringe jacket and the furry boots and all of that stuff. Doug had a good time. I was in a goddamn mental institution. You know, it's like, I was in San Francisco during the summer of love, man. I'm sorry I missed it, but I physically was there, you know, but I was busy getting hammered. You know, I mean, it was just, you know, I missed a lot of it. I missed a lot of it. And mental institution at 22, and I had 15 more years to go. So when I got here at 37, I was on my second marriage, the second wife, and I had a second set of two children. My daughter was 3 years old. My son was 4 months old. And I lived in the house with this second wife and these kids, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. That's just hindsight. I didn't know it. When you don't have compassion, you're not capable of connecting with people. You don't know that. You know, it feels like you're connected. You know, they're in your way. You're interacting with them. But I can't feel you. The only time I'm really concerned about how you feel is when how you feel impacts me in some way. Then I'm concerned. But I don't really feel, I am not connected to you. Silkworth says an interesting thing in the doctor's opinion. He's a non-alcoholic looking at us, and he says, we lose touch with all things human. What an interesting insight. When I read the book with guys, I bring that to their attention. I say, what do you think he means by that? And I think alcoholics in their cups, we unplug from society. I'm not connected to you. I don't have an interdependence. You know, I can manipulate and con and, you know, but I'm not really connected to what's going on around me. And I have no idea that that's true. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. I don't know that. The alcoholic life literally seems like the only normal one. And I don't know that. So one night, so far it's been the last night, I was up drinking all night. And there are certain spiritual truths, I believe. And one of them is that alcohol plus money equals cocaine. And This is not an outside issue. It's a very inside issue. That's the reason God gave us cocaine, so that alcoholics could drink more. That's what it's for. And so I'm doing that, you know. There was no more rock and roll in my life. There wasn't any party going on. I was 300 plus pounds, fat, sweaty. I had liver disease and didn't know how bad it was. I had, you know, cirrhosis, but I had no idea how bad it was. I had hepatitis C, and I didn't know that. They called it non-A, non-B, and I was very sick, and I would have been dead within a couple of years, as it turned out. 5 years ago, I had a liver transplant. It almost killed me over 30 years of sobriety, you know, so, but I was very sick then. But I was up all night one more time, and I don't know about you, but there's nothing more depressing than when the sun comes up and you know it's going to be another miserable day in a long line of miserable days. And my little daughter woke up in the middle of the night early in the morning, and she came out in the living room, and she was really happy to see that Daddy was up, and she crawled up in my lap, and I just lost it. I just started crying as best I can remember. I was really pretty hammered, but I remember her crawling up in my lap, so that morning, like any good gangster, I called my mom. And this was a woman that had been in Al-Anon for 30 years by that time. My dad got sober in 1954, and I grew up in a house that was very active in AA and Al-Anon for a long time. And she came over and got me quickly and checked me into a place called Starting Point in Costa Mesa. And I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. And then they let me out, like they just let us out, like we're okay now, you know, go forth, multiply. And where do we end up? In Alcoholics Anonymous, the world's aftercare program. That's where we end up. You know, when all the money runs out, when all the insurance money runs out, when they're all done gestalting and rolfing and primal screaming and do whatever they do, they dump us here in AA, where the inmates are running the asylum. We are the counselors here, aren't we? We are the experts. We're the people. You stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times, and I've been to a lockdown mental institution with barbed wire on top of the fence 2 times. And people ask me for relationship advice. And I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA, man. You know, it's like, you know. It's like people, I do these sponsorship workshops, and every once in a while you'll get a question like, well, what if the newcomer asks me a question? I don't have the answer. I just tell them, just make shit up. They don't know. It's like, you know, it's like, go find out the answer, come back and fix it later. They're going to be around a while, hopefully, you know, you can repair the damage. And it's like, what a crazy place this is, you know. So the day they let me out of the recovery place, I walked into my first outside the recovery place AA meeting. The first AA meeting I went to, other than when I was a kid, my parents used to drag me along and I'd sit in the kitchen and bring out the donuts at the break and stuff like that. You know, my first real AA meeting, you know, was at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club on a Friday night in April of 85. It was summertime, it was springtime, beautiful night, I remember. And I got out of that place that day, and I knew I was going to drink again. I felt safe inside that place, but I hadn't been sober for over 30 days since I was 14 or 15 years old, that I can recall. And so it's a raw place, isn't it, when they take away the medication? It's a rough place. I felt very self-conscious, but I went to that Alano Club. I'd never been there before. I went to that clubhouse, and I walked up there, coming in right on time, right? Who knew that an AA meeting would be full on a Friday night in the springtime in the South Bay? Why would people flock to an AA meeting? And all the Harleys were parked out front, which I was intrigued by. I wasn't expecting that, you know, and I walked up and I walked in there and there was nowhere to sit down because the place was packed. And I stood in the back of the room and I didn't feel part of because I wasn't. I didn't know anybody. I'd never been there before. And they're laughing and joking and hooting and hollering. The nicknames are flying around. A lot of people said it was called the Gong Show. A lot of people said it wasn't really an AA meeting. I went to it for 20 years. It was a party. It was Friday night. Everybody's dressed up trying to hook up. You know, I mean, that's exactly. And I was not expecting that. This was not some dour place. A lot of people were offended by it. You know, there was a lot of cussing going on. But I'm an old hippie from the 60s. Weird has always attracted me. And to this day, 37 years later, I find you all deliciously strange. I just think I've never lost my sense of intriguing about AA. And that night was a good example of that. And I started laughing. They were hooting their friends up on the podium and hooting them off. One guy got down off the podium because they were just hooting so loud they wouldn't stop, and he just went and sat down. But it was all friendly. It was funny. It wasn't mean-spirited. You know, it was just a riot. And I drove home that night, and the very first lucky thing happened to me in AA. It's just pure luck, but I think it's very significant. I just liked it right from the start. I just liked it, and I've never lost that. I mean, God knows you have pissed me off. I don't get the respect I deserve on a regular basis. You know, all of that has happened to me. You know, after all I've done for you and all that, I've done all that stupid ass stuff, you know, but I have never been bored in AA. And I can tell you, if you're sitting out there today and you're bored, it's because you're boring. It's not us. You know, I mean, I drove home that night and I said to myself, you know, this may not be so bad. And it's proven to be true. It just hasn't been so bad at all. You know, I've never drifted away from AA. I've always been around. One night I got pissed off at something and I stormed out of the room and I'm walking across the parking lot at night. And I stopped and actually had the thought, Bill, where are you going? Where are you going to go? You know, because there's really no, you know, there's no referrals from AA. There's no place you go where you walk in into and you say to them, I'm from AA, they sent me here. That place literally doesn't exist. This is it. This is the last house on the street. You know, if this doesn't work out, there's no other place to go, you know, that I'm aware of, you know. And so I turned around and walked back in the room. You know, where am I going to go? There's just no way. That's happened to me. Similar things like that several times. Like, I'm done with this shit, you know, and there's just nowhere to go. I get over it pretty quickly. So I've stayed here the whole time and I've had a great, great time in AA. The second thing happened to me that was just lucky is a couple of weeks after that experience, I asked a guy to help me and he actually did, which doesn't always happen. And he said to me, I asked him for help and he said to me, go home and read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't. Be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock and we'll discuss it. So the bottom to me is the collapse of the ego, isn't it? You know, the bottom that we hit, we get that gift of desperation. You know, the ego, the defense mechanism drops, the window opens up and it comes back. So you gotta jump in there pretty quickly. And that night when that man said that to me, against my past behavior ever, I just did what he said. I just, okay, we had a conversation, right? But I said, I went home and I read my little assignment and I made my little notes in the margin and I showed up at this stranger's house. I didn't know his last name. And I showed up and I knocked on the door and he did a very intimate thing with me. He invited me into his house and we sat in his living room, just the two of us, no one else was around. And we read that book together. He didn't trust me that I'd read it and he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. Now I've had the same sponsor for 37 years and I should have fired him several times, but he needs me now. You know, I mean, I make him look good. and the poor guy, and he's still very enthusiastic for AA. He's kind of an idiot about it, really. He embarrasses me in public on a fairly regular basis. He's just such a nerd, and he's just so happy. My wife calls him Mr. Happy, you know? It's like that's a character defect, right? The guy's always positive. What's wrong with that? You know, what a weirdo. You know, doesn't he realize how horrible things are? Evidently not. It's like, you know, but we've done workshops around a good part of the world over the years. Who knew that that was going to, who knew that anybody would be interested in what I had to say about anything? And in AA, it's turned out, you know, I've become somewhat of a spokesman. Like Israel says about himself, he's one of the greatest speakers in AA, right? Well, I'm right there behind, right next to him. Boy, I'm hot property in AA. You know, AA thinks I'm really cool, right? And it's just too bad I'm a one-trick pony, man. Let me and Yisrael, we're driving the short bus, right? And here we are in AA. We've become rock stars in AA, whatever that is about, right? And, you know, for the first 10 years I was sober, I was trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. And God bless AA, they let me do that. You know, people just pat me on the head and go ahead, kid. Give it your best shot, you know? The pay's great, right? It's like, this is a great career path here. But that's all I had to work with, right? And it served me well because I did a lot of stuff and I've had a wonderful time in AA. But this guy, each week I went back to his house and we read another chapter in the book and he guided me through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 6 months sober, I did a fifth step and I had one of those experiences we have around here. I went home after doing that fifth step and I thought about the guy that walked through that door 6 months previous. And it struck me, it's going to be like this now. The old life, whatever that was, evidently is over. And I was 6 months sober. 6 months. That is a lifetime. That's a lifetime. We have a joke in my home group, the Hermosa Beach Men Stag, when we hand out chips, nobody stays sober 9 months. That's just, we hand out very few 9 month chips. You know, there's 50 guys in the room. It's like, but there's this joke, but man, that 6 months is a long time. When someone gets a 6 month chip in my home group, he gets like a standing ovation. I mean, it's like, whoa, that's an immense amount of time. And I remember that clearly, of having a really clear thought of this, to me, which is in a spiritual experience, that what happened on March the 27th, something touched me. Now, we can struggle over what that may or may not have been, but you cannot deny the fact that I was touched because it changed the course of my life. That's the evidence of a spiritual experience. When something happens, it changes the course of our lives. And all of us in AA have had that experience. All of us that are sitting here, something touched us that changed the very course of my life. In a year I was sponsoring guys, I started making amends. So it says in our book in the 10th step, right? Israel talked about the fact we go through all 9 steps and then they hit us with more inventory shit on 10. What's that? We did it already. Are we going to keep doing this? Evidently, that's the way it's laid out, right? So it says in that 10th step that the only thing that's going to save us, keep us sober, give us a life with some quality, maybe some purpose, maybe some intimacy in our relationships, all that stuff, is our spiritual condition and the maintenance of that. So evidently, I need to get a spiritual condition so that I can maintain it. And it says that we've got these things called laurels that we're going to rest on. Well, I guess I got to get some laurels so I can rest on them and find out why that's a problem. Because I have no laurels. Laurel is a past achievement, right? I have none of that. I don't have any of that. But now that I'm sober, I'm 6 months sober, I'm going to start this process, right? That I'm going to develop some kind of a spiritual condition. My sponsor told me that his job as my sponsor is to guide me through the process of the 12 steps, that I might have some kind of a spiritual awakening. And maybe I won't drink again for the rest of my life because that happens here. Maybe that'll happen. He says, I'd be happy to sit here and listen to you tell me what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings. The meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how my day went. And I told them down there at the Ilano Club, they are breaking that rule right and left. Should we go tell them? And he goes, no. He says, AA is a safe place. I'm just describing to you my Alcoholics Anonymous. So another lucky thing, I ran into somebody that doesn't believe this weird thing that we say around here, that we don't give advice or express opinions. I mean, if we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have much to say to each other. I don't know where the hell that came from. And I'm a newcomer in AA. I need some good advice. I don't need to be told what to do, but I need some good advice, because everywhere I go is a rude place. I mean, I am the center of attention. Everybody's looking at me, talking about me behind my back. You know, I'm the guy that walks in the room, and if you're looking at me, it's what the hell are you looking at? And if you're not looking at me, I'm heartbroken. And there's no middle ground in here. We're not talking about levels of emotional development. You know, I'm a raw nerve. And I'm a loud raw nerve too, by the way. I combine that with a big mouth and trying to assert myself and covering up fear with a lot of bravado. And I don't even know I'm doing that. You know, I mean, I have no clue. This is all looking backwards. And you were so patient with me. Some of you got in my face, and together we journeyed the road of aggressiveness and figuring out how not to be that way. You ever had to go up to somebody in AA that you don't like and make amends so that you can rid yourself of the resentment you have against that son of a bitch? That's a rough one, you know? But if you get some good advice in AA, that's the advice that you'll get, you know? You need to get that guy off your back. Go make amends to him and then avoid him like the plague. You know, stay fucking, it's like, and I've done that. And people have done that to me. People, you know, I've been the source of other people making amends, you know? I mean, every once in a while you get one of those phone calls. Some guy calls you up on the phone because he doesn't want to confront you physically and tells you that he's always hated you. You know, and the last time that happened to me, I said, who's your sponsor? It's like, oh man, what a journey. So the first thing that this guy wanted to know from me is that whether I believed I was powerless over drugs and alcohol, right? And that was easy for me. I was very sick and I was done, as it turns out. I mean, I could cop to that. But what I've discovered many years later is that powerlessness is about everything. Now, any mystical path that you go down, most religious ones, any mystical path talks about the idea of personal powerlessness. Essentially that we are not running the show and we're living our lives like we're running the show. I live my life in such a way, if you looked at it from the outside, that evidently what I believe is that things outside myself need to be different in order for me to be okay. That you are the source of all my bad behavior. You're the source of all the turmoil in my life. I talk to you incessantly about how if you were a little bit different, the two of us would be a hell of a lot happier. And you insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core. I've lost complete control of the geopolitical situation in the world. Look at it, right? I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything in my life that I have any power or control over. And that's the source of all the suffering in my life, is my inability to accept that fact. And in AA, we talk about acceptance a lot. And my take on acceptance is, if I really get how powerless I am, acceptance just happens. There's no other choice. I don't have to like it, but I have to accept it. And when that happens, the suffering stops. There's things I don't like, but the suffering stops. Expecting it to be different than it is and believing that it needs to be different in order for me to be okay, that's the source of all the suffering in my life. So it seems as though powerlessness, this idea, concept, and experience of powerlessness is the first pillar of spiritual condition. That's the first thing they want to know from us, right? And as the longer I'm sober, the more specific it becomes how powerless I am over everything. And I don't need any power. It seems to be unfolding all on its own, right? If I can grasp just the drugs and alcohol, the second step then becomes operational. I need to align myself with the power. And it's a logical thought progression. If I'm not running things, something is, because it's unfolding in front of me, all around me. It seems to be unfolding all the time. And somehow, for some odd reason, the human experience, I feel separate from that unfoldingness. I think I'm outside the circle, like there's even a circle. I mean, Chuck Chamberlain drew the circle and everything inside of it, and then the little stick man on the outside, right? And what I've come to realize, there's no circle. I can't possibly be outside or separate from nature. And yet I feel that, don't we? We talk about that like it's an aspect of alcoholism. It's an aspect of being human, this sense of separateness. The ego is there to create this separation between me and other objects so that I can interact with them. But the truth is, that's an illusion. It's a delusion. I can't be separate, yet I feel that way. And there's lots of powers that are greater than me. I mean, gravity comes to mind. It's like you get old, you start falling down, man, that's a problem. You know, it's like, you know, getting up is the issue. Going down is pretty easy. Getting up is a little difficult. The electrodynamic force, you know, it seems to be greater than me. There's lots of powers that are greater than me. Alcoholics Anonymous is a really good power greater than yourself. It's very real. I don't know about you, but when I walk in rooms with you, and I can even get it from Zoom, but live it's better. I feel the energy of being in a room with people that are conscious of the fact that their lives have been saved. I feel that's a real thing for me. I've been feeding off of that for years. And it's so good to be back live with you and feel the energy of that. That's a power greater than myself. And I am part of that power. I am not separate from that power. I love the line, you know, that what you're looking for, you're looking with. There's nothing outside myself I need to get to bring inside me that then be okay. There, everything. I am a self-contained unit. I have everything I need. I just can't see it. I can't see it. I'm blind to it. So the second step is all I need to know about God is it's not me. People will tell you around here, you have to have a God to do AA. No, you don't. All you got to do is stick around. It will come and visit you, right? And then you can label it with whatever makes you feel comfortable, but you can't avoid it around here. I mean, every room you walk into, it's there, whether you can sense it or not. Then the third step becomes operational. Now, that's interesting. They're telling me that I'm going to make a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of what clearly already has it anyway. I think it was nice of them to lead me to believe that I actually have some say in the matter. I think that was a little ego twist. They'll feel better if we tell them that they can decide, right? You know, well, I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. Where's my trophy? Right? It's like, and we have these wonderful discussions about the difference between my will and God's will. My little ego that presented itself at about 2.5 years old, the terrible twos, they call it. It loves the idea of us having a battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe. How is that even possible? Really? Really? We talk about the difference between my will and God's will, you know? And what is God's will? We talk a lot about what is God's will. Clearly, God's will is what's happening right now. And I don't like that, so I'm looking for an alternative. You know, I have problems with the way things are right now. They need to be different in order for me to be okay, and I suffer, right? What life and will is the third step talking about? Isn't it the inventory, the end result of living a life with seeming power? I've got resentments, I've got fears, and I've got broken sexual relationships. That's what I bring. That's who I am. That's my personality. I'm making a list of who I am. I just don't know that yet. That comes up later, you know? And I don't want to do it, but I do it. I do it. And then I do the fifth step. And what's the lesson in the inventory process? That 6 months sober when I shared that inventory with that guy. And God knows I'd been to a lot of therapy. I did 2.5 years of group therapy at one time. And it's easy for me to talk about myself. But I told this man stuff because of this format, too. I told him stuff I never told anybody. There's no reason to tell anybody some of this stuff. And the lesson, the second pillar of spiritual condition is I have to stop blaming other people and institutions for my problems. High school is over. This is not serving me well. That's how the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. It's got to be someone else's fault, right? And I had my first inventory. I had the entire federal government, specifically the Department of Motor Vehicles. Who the hell are they to tell me whether I can drive or not? I mean, that's who I am, is who I'm angry at, the resentments that I hold, and the broken relationships that, you know, if you were treated the way I was treated, you'd be angry too. You'd drink too. That's me. So I have to stop the blaming. And if you surround yourself with some relatively healthy people in AA, including your peers that you're getting sober with, they will help you to stop the blaming, but it's going to be years before that really stops. It's so ingrained in me, but I open the door to, I have to stop this. It's not serving me well. If you hang out in the parking lot outside the meetings, you can find other people that will help support you in all this whining and crying. If you walk in the room, you're probably, it's going to be the beginning of the end of it. In my home group, the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, years ago, if some guy would come in there and start sharing about his wife and how awful she is or his girlfriend, we would start clapping till he stopped. I was very impressed by that when I was new. I thought, man, that's some hard-ass shit right there, you know? I mean, we're not going to be able to stand around in here and whine about our wives and bitch about the kids and stuff. No, evidently not. That's not what we're here for. I'm very grateful for that. AA, what I've learned in AA is man school. It's woman school too. It's not just the men. But the men in AA really, to a great degree, have taught me how to grow up. It's time for Bill to grow up and pay his bills and make his amends and do the right thing. Do the right thing. Mostly by their example. So then we get into the amends process. In the amends process, you want these people that I'm angry at and stuff, you want me to go to them and clean up my, I'm not doing that. This makes no sense to me. And it's frightening. And I'll tell you something, in the amends, in the ninth step, this is where the transformation really begins. When I go to somebody that I don't ever want to see again, and I look them right in the eye and I say the words that need to be said, pay back the money, whatever needs, when I turn and walk away from that experience, I am changed right then and there. No waiting. This is a cathartic experience. It will change us. It changes us right on the spot. This is when I start feeling better about myself. I confront a real fear. This is a real fear. I don't want to see these people. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed and sometimes frightened, right? And when I do that, when I confront that, I will not be the same. It'll change me. You put yourself at the bottom of that amends list, by the time you get there, you'll have some self-esteem. That's what I was told. And that is very true for me. I started becoming a badass in AA. I made my amends. Have you? You know, that's the old macho in me, the old biker in me. You know, I'm doing it. What's your problem? God damn it. I mean, I wasn't shy about it. You know, they say, do something good for somebody and then don't tell anybody. I don't know that I've ever accomplished that, man. Everything I've done in AA, I let everybody know about it, so that I can get the awards and the patches and the, and sometimes when I forget to say something, later on I'll go back and clean it up and let you all know. You know, 6 months ago, that kind of stuff. Ego can be a good positive driving force. You know, I want to get credit for all my shit. And 1 through 9 is about 10% of the program. And the big lesson in the amends process is nothing was ever personal. No one was ever doing anything to me. They were just doing what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius of their behavior. And sometimes you're in the blast radius of my behavior. But the third pillar of spiritual condition is nothing was ever personal. This is a shock to the system. 1 through 9 is 10%. 10, 11, and 12 is 90% of the program. That's the real work, is 10, 11, and 12. That's the real work. The rest of it, it's just sober 101. It's the first semester. The real work, the 10th step, is about making amends in the present moment, right? And I get it now. When you come to a place in this process where you realize, oh my God, it's me. It's me. It was never them. I was so wrong about everything. Nobody was focused on me. They're just doing what they do, and I'm just doing what I do. It was never personal. And one of the signs of a selfish, self-centered person, like a teenager, is everything is personal. It's all happening to me, and that just simply isn't true. And I can tell you, the fourth pillar of spiritual condition in that 10th step is self-awareness as compared to self-obsession. And when you realize self-awareness without humor is depression. Some of us have a good reason to be depressed. You stand there and you realize, oh shit, oh my God, it's me. And we do a wonderful job in AA of helping each other laugh at who we think we are. I mean, the people in AA that would be speakers or whoever would really expose themselves in AA, that's who has always attracted me. Somebody that was willing to do that, like to not pretend. Like you hear speakers say, I hate being a speaker. There's so much ego in it. What a bunch of bullshit. We love this stuff, man. I mean, I'm the center of attention. You're all listening quietly. What's not to like about that? And I'd hear guys like Scott Redman would do that. He would expose himself, right? And I love that about him. I pursued him for years. I tried to get close to him. He kept me at arm's length. He didn't want anything to do with me. Finally, he comes up to me and says, we should have dinner. And I said, I've been pursuing you for years. He goes, yes, and I'm finally caving in. It's like, you know, it's like, and he just gave up under the pressure of me wanting to be close to him. Steve Lamb is here too. And Steve was very close to Scott. And he was a treasure, that guy. When the first time I heard him speak, I go, that's what I want to do. What he's doing there, that's what I want to do. What a message that man had. In the 11th step, we can watch ourselves think. We can sit and focus on the breath, and the ego doesn't like being in the present moment, so it wanders away from the breath. And I notice it has wandered away, and I gently bring it back. So evidently, the essence of who I am is not my thinking mind. Isn't that something? I mean, certainly I have consciousness, right? But evidently there's another consciousness within me that's able to watch the one that I think is me. Wow. 20 years sober, that became real in my life. I started meditating with real intent. Finally, I can stop working on myself. I'm just feeding the beast. This is a game-changing experience, the realization of this. Evidently, I do not have to go where it wants to take me. When it wants to go into the darkness, I don't have to go. I can recognize it's doing that and come back to the present moment. And the present moment has a texture and a feel to it. And when I'm not in it, I recognize that I'm not there. And I can return to it because I've got some experience of what it feels like to be there. You exercise that muscle, that awareness muscle, and life gets better. You know, the pain doesn't end of life, but the suffering certainly does. I do not have to be a victim of my thinking. That's a real gift. That's true here. That happens here. And the final pillar, the final one, the 12th step is the mechanism that brings all this about. AA is not good psychotherapy because it's not about me. People in AA, I hear people say, I'm looking for the true self. What if there's nothing there? What if what you're looking for literally doesn't exist? What if there truly is no separation between me and others or me and nature? What if I am an integral part? And the illusion that the gurus talks about is this idea that I'm a standalone separate entity and I have no dependence on others. We are not independent of each other nor of nature. That's what I've come to believe. In the 12th step, I reach out and I start trying to help you, even if I'm motivated by self. Doesn't matter what the motivation is, because what happens when I try to reach out to you is over time, I fall in love with you. I have fallen in love with you. I started truly caring about what happens to you. You can't avoid that when somebody invites you into their life or you invite them into your life. They've become an integral part of who I am. I used to think I was the teacher and you're the student. And the truth is, you have always been the teacher. Whenever I've reached out for help, he sends me you. And the spiritual experiences I've had usually include you. When we talk here about watching the light come on in people's eyes, that's a very real thing. You stop and think about this. This is the heart and soul of AA. People's lives are saved here every day. And the instrument or tool that's used for that is us. We are literally the instrument of God's will. We say the words, we drive the car. Have you ever caught yourself saying something that you didn't know you knew to somebody? I gave a guy one time a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life. And after he left the room, I thought, man, that's some really good shit. I should record that. And then I thought, maybe I should even do some of it. And I called my sponsor and I said, Jay, I'm a hypocrite. And he goes, no, you're not. You're a liar. It's worse than you think. It's like, I mean, I will see myself through your eyes much better than I'll ever flesh it out on my own. Any prejudice I have will walk across the room and ask me for help. This guy came across the room and he asked me, he says, will you sponsor me? I think I should tell you I'm gay. I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? And he said, no. He says, I got the gay thing down pretty good, but alcoholism is kicking my ass. who knew? Who knew? That's how it works here. And my sense is, my arrogance, I will tell you, if you're really not working with others, you're really not doing AA. That's all there is to do here. This is it. This is the thing. This is why we're here. This is how AA grows. And I'll leave you with this thought. They say here, you got to give it away to keep it. No, you have to give it away to even get it. That's how you get it, is by giving it away. Thank you very much for having me.